Educators flourishing. This is a phrase all educational leaders would love to use to describe their team. Over recent episodes of this podcast, we have heard great examples of how coaching has had a positive impact on educators. And today, I'm really pleased to be joined by educator flourishing specialist, Brittany Rehal, all the way from California. Brittany has been an educator for the past decade, and founded and led educator well-being programs, as well as authoring faculty well-being policies for schools in China, the Middle East, and the US. Brittany earned her Master's of Education from the University of California, Santa Barbara, and her Master's of Science in Applied Positive Psychology and Coaching Psychology from the University of East London. Brittany is a grounded theory researcher and has created the Ecological Model for Flourishing Educators, with co-author Christian van Nieuwburg. This full article has been accepted to the International Journal of Wellbeing, pending publication in June 2022. Brittany is currently conducting research with the Masters of Applied Positive Psychology and Coaching Psychology alumni research team at University of East London, researching the experiences of staff and students within the programme. Now, for our listeners who attended the 2022 GCI Coaching Conference online, you may well have had the opportunity of hearing Brittany share something of her experiences around educator flourishing. And we thought it would be appropriate to share her story with an even wider audience via our Coaching in Education podcast. So as your host, Richard Reed, I invite you to join me as Brittany shares her thoughts on educator flourishing. Brittany, it's such a pleasure to welcome you to the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here and have another conversation with you.
Brittany, we had the pleasure of listening to you present at the 2022 GCI conference, where you shared your journey into education and how you have developed a passion for what you call educator flourishing. For those listeners who today might be hearing you for the first time, can you give us a whistle-stop tour of your journey in education so far, and also an overview of what educator flourishing means?
I fortunately was able to take several opportunities to be able to teach abroad and experience what it was like to be an educator in different cultures and countries. And I was able to learn that with the structure of each school being different, one thing that remained the same was me feeling like I wasn't seen, valued, trusted, or heard in any positions or roles that I held. And as an educator, the story I told myself was that, well, once I become an educational leader, I will get to feel what this feels like. And then I became an educational leader and realized that there is always, often in my experience, but there's someone on top and there's someone who controls the power of whether it's disseminated and shared or it's held over. And so I realized that while my ability to share power expanded in an educational leadership role, it wasn't enough to create lasting change. And I felt very alone in what I was feeling as an educator and as an educational leader. So when I turned to the literature, my feelings were validated and felt even heavier when there was a lack of research on educator flourishing. So I saw this need and experienced the importance of identifying the need to unpack what needed to change in order for educators to feel seen, valued, trusted, and heard. And so with Christian van Nieuwburg in our research, we created a definition to define flourishing educator as an educator who feels seen, trusted, and valued. They are treated as a professional and encouraged to be authentic. They have autonomy, integrity, agency, and experience positive relationships along with personal and professional growth. And there's a lot in there, and there's a model that goes along with it to help us see that visually. And there was a big, you know, discussion about teacher versus educator. And because we, of our participants that we interviewed, we had participants who were educators from HEIs, from higher education institutes, who were from local schools, who were from international schools, who were from elementary schools, you know, community college. And so there was so many different types of educators, and it felt much more inclusive to say educator than to say teacher. Because when we say teacher, everyone has an image that comes to mind. So that's why we chose educator. And then for flourishing, we I saw that flourishing was a continuum, that when I reached out to people and educators who identified as flourishing, they all fell at a different line on the continuum of flourishing. And well-being felt that it wasn't the right language for what we were looking into. It was about the thriving and the flourishing of our educators in every aspect of their position and their role at school and how they are able to show up to their schools. And so the goal was to normalize this language and prioritize educator flourishing to be able to start reimagining our educational systems and creating better and more sustainable, long-lasting ways for educators to feel that their flourishing is the priority.
Fantastic. And it's interesting, and it's lovely to hear as you give us that context, starting from your own personal experiences. And it wasn't just in one school. As you say, it was in schools, and not even just within the States, it's schools around the world that you had this experience in. And you used that phrase or those words that you weren't seen, valued, trusted, or heard. So this was your own personal experience. And then, as you say yourself, there was obviously a gap in the research, which was another reason to spur you on to I suppose, get heavily involved in this type of work. And it's interesting when you mentioned the phrase well-being, Brittany. In our initial conversation prior to this recording, you mentioned something that came up in your research that really resonated with me. And that was how at times there can be genuine misunderstanding and maybe misinformation around the topic of well-being in schools. Can you share with us a little bit more about this?
Yes. And what this looks like in education is a lot of window dressing. And what I mean by that is, you know, you might walk by a classroom and you see this beautiful display of all the things that students are working on, and it looks amazing. And sometimes you go in and it's even further enhanced and there's so much. But other times you go in and that's the only decoration. And that's the whole point of, like, okay, we're having a tour of the school and we need to make sure that all the windows look great, right? And so, unfortunately, that's what's happening in its own way with well-being, where schools are realizing, okay, you know, this is important. We need to talk about this. And it's great that the word and the intention is there, right? But as what's happening in our world right now, there's this big debate about intention versus impact. And I see this really clearly with well-being, because there's a beautiful intention to spread awareness of well-being. But in actuality, it's very common that schools use this term well-being, and they place the responsibility on educators to, let's say, take a well-being course, or they say, okay, you know, see, we're providing this option. You can, on every Thursday, you can take a well-being course. So in that example, the educators have the option to choose this path, yet they're adding something on to a list without taking something off. So it's an additional responsibility. And another route that I've seen is where there is a mandatory well-being program where the school says, we care so much about you that today, for 2 hours after your full teaching day, we're going to talk about your well-being with an expert. And the experts are wonderful, but the choice is taken away from the teacher. So that autonomy is gone. And then the educators enter with all their emotions of what they bring with being told what to do to a workshop that's supposed to be designed to help them thrive. So there's this disconnect here. And then in general, when we look at well-being, you know, we see how COVID has highlighted the importance of companies, you know, and organizations addressing well-being, especially when we look at, you know, the Great Resignation and all this, like, new research coming behind that. And again, while there are exceptional well-being programs that do exist and exceptional companies that do exist, so often in companies, organizations, and schools, the programs or services that have that label of well-being are actually addressing symptoms of systemic things that need to be better, rather than the problem, going to the root of the problem to fix it. And what happens is that leads to temporary relief rather than lasting change, which takes longer and is harder to do. So that's part of the half truth of well-being that can be exchanged that way.
I love that phrase, that the half truth of well-being. But I get what you say, and I mean, as I suppose as a principal myself over many years, you know, I understand what you mean by window dressing. And I mean, some schools, we are exceptionally good addressing windows in many different contexts and for a lot of different reasons, and I suppose well-being would definitely be one of those. And I like your phrase where you talk about intention versus impact. And I would imagine, yes, right around the world, because this is a global podcast, you know, there are educators out there who have the very best intentions, especially when it comes to well-being. But what you've noticed yourself in a lot of different schools, the intention is there, but the impact doesn't necessarily arrive. And this idea of choice and autonomy just really isn't there. And again, you know, I like your idea where sometimes well-being can be something that's done to teachers in many ways. And again, sometimes very well intentioned. But again, there's no choice and there's no autonomy in there. This idea of a temporary relief rather than lasting change. And I suppose this is what I suppose has inspired you to get very much involved in this line of work. You'd mentioned earlier on in the conversation, Brittany, this ecological model for flourishing educators, which sounds fantastic. Can you give us a wee bit more of explanation around that and how maybe coaching fits in with that?
Yes, in our model, we can start with the soil. I'll paint a picture for the listeners. So we have the soil The overarching label would be leaders prioritizing educator flourishing, with prioritizing in italics. Initially, I had it in capital bold, and Christian convinced me that italicize it. But it was very important to me that that was prioritizing. And what that looks like in the soil is shared language. It's the inclusive we around decisions, around communication. It's professional and personal growth. It's creating an environment for growth, and coaching is in that soil as well. Mm-hmm. And from the soil, we come up to the roots, and the roots are the things our educators need, which educators need as along with the nourishment they receive from students, mentors, coaches, and leaders along their journey. And those are the components of feeling seen, trusted, and valued, being treated as a professional, receiving recognition and acknowledgement. So that it makes up the roots of our tree for our flourishing educator. And the body of the flourishing educator comes up into the leaves. And in the leaves, we see the educator's identity and the visible traits that are given permission to exist from the nourishment from the roots and the soil. So these things are possible by that nourishment, which are positive relationships, agency, authenticity, autonomy, integrity, professional and personal growth. And those make up the leaves of the tree. And then the comprehensive model has on the right side, we have the sun, and the sun is how leaders earn trust. And the reason I chose the sun for that is because it's a way of being. In this instance, leaders are earning trust by existing and through components like transparency, vulnerability, intellectual humility, will, and integrity, which is their alignment with values evidenced through their behavior. And then the water, the last piece is the water, which is the active piece from leadership, which is how leaders demonstrate trust. And this looks like empathy, presuming positive intentions, granting educators autonomy, and educator-driven decision-making. And one of the biggest takeaways from creating the model and from designing it this way is that the ownership is not solely on the educator. There are so many environmental components that go into the nourishment of this tree. And taking one thing away doesn't mean that the tree ceases to exist. It just will grow in different rates because of that element not being there. And another reason we chose the tree model is because trees affect the environment simply by existing and change the environment around them just by being there. And then the coaching components, as I mentioned in, you know, a couple of places, is very similar to the sun as a way of being, right? That's one of our goals as coaches, is to have this way of being. And because the sun, you know, is simply existing and we get to reap the benefits of receiving that light, coaching is so similar, and courageous leaders simply exist, you know, in order, and then they benefit from earning trust from their educators by existing in that way.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of Michael Stanier when he talks about, you know, advice versus questioning, right? And how the best advice can be to ask a question, because when you have a really powerful question, it's used over and over again. And advice, you know, is actually contingent upon a specific situation or experience and can't usually be recycled. So in the way that a good question can be revisited over and over, that's what happens with our environment when we can create those environments of coaching cultures that continually perpetuate change and growth and new learnings simply by existing and giving that culture permission to grow.
Fantastic. And it's lovely even to hear the vocabulary that you use when you're describing the model. You can see, you know, the core aspects of coaching coming through as you've explained so well. Wouldn't it be just fantastic, Brittany, as you explain and describe your ecological model? We talked at the very start there about window dressing. Wouldn't it just be fantastic for you to walk into a school somewhere and see an example of the ecological model for flourishing educators up on a wall? Wouldn't that be tremendous? Walking down the corridor and saying, that's something that I come up with. So that, and thank you for sharing that with us so well. Brittany, I'd love you to tell us a bit more about your actual coaching practice and how, as well as having student one-to-one sessions, which you have, you also go that extra mile to include, for example, members of their families in coaching conversations.
Yes, this is something we contract in the beginning of sessions with students where families sign. So we typically have a coaching contract, coachee and coach, and our contracts have coachee, coach, and parents of the coachee. And when students take positive psychology coaching sessions with me, we have a monthly check-in with families where the families sit down with me and we have a coaching session together, because children and all learners benefit from accountability and consistency in language. So while coaching is one form of accountability, it's strengthened when children see their parents investing their own time in the coaching process, or their guardians or whoever that they're home with the predominant amount of time.
Yeah.
And another layer is just how supportive that feels for the child who's being coached, because they see, they just need to look and see, and they have a whole team of people that's in their corner. And then the language piece comes from what kind of language is emerging in our coaching sessions. You know, as coaches, we know that when a coachee uses a term, we don't make assumptions. We ask them to define it for them and make that clear for them. So when we use terms that maybe have a different connotation, like safety, we might think of something different, but to that child, they're not talking about that type of safety. They're talking about psychological safety, or they're talking about environmental safety, something completely different. So normalizing those terms for the parents so that they can reinforce that at home and understand their children. And then additionally, as we progress in our coaching relationship, then we have this child come in for the second half of that check-in. So the first 30 minutes is me and the families, we're doing our coaching session. And then we come as a group with a group coaching session to have that child be a part of that and feel empowered to share what they want to share in that moment.
Brittany, you've spent considerable amount of time studying positive psychology. Can you share with us what impact that has had on your coaching work?
I have had an experience, so many experiences in various teaching and coaching roles.
Yeah.
As an educator, as a leader, a mentor, a coach. I was a boxing coach in college. I was a group fitness instructor. Then I became a researcher and a student. And I used to feel like I had all these different modalities that I could tap into. And I've realized that there's a really beautiful way that these disciplines can all be integrated into creating a really unique approach to coaching, where I have this fluidity in moving through them and integrating them in a way. So sometimes when we talk about positive psychology coaching, we think about them as a lens in which we view the world, and it informs our coaching approach. And it's also part of just who we are as an integrated human. So for me, one of the biggest impacts of positive psychology on coaching is the awareness of what flourishing looks like, because having that awareness is a really big driver behind how I coach and how I move through the conversation. Because when I'm prioritizing the coachee's flourishing, it becomes very clear what the route is to go, which means sometimes I'm adapting into solution-focused coaching, and other times I'm switching into, you know, the last part of a model rather than starting with the first part. And, you know, we know as coaches that we bounce around a little bit, but, yes. You know, having that focus and understanding and clear picture of the flourishing itself really informs where I go with the coachee as they decide where the conversation goes as well.
Fantastic. Brittany, one phrase you used during your involvement in the 2022 GCI conference really intrigued me, and it ties in with a wee bit with that previous question, and it was supported, developed decision capital. Could you share with us and our listeners what you mean by that and how it fits in so well with a coaching approach to leadership in schools?
So two parts to this answer. The first part is the permission for educators to think for themselves and be part of the decision-making process in a school. Mm-hmm. And similarly to the window dressing of well-being, this isn't a ticking the box we asked them and they told us. It's, you know, that they see how their decisions are impacting the system of their school. Mm. And for our research, we used the definition for agency that we used was from a participant who shared. And what the participant said is, when I talk about agency, I'm talking about where there is scope and where we have supported, developed people making informed decisions about their work, their time, their space, and their instructional practice. Mm-hmm. And that was summarized into supported, developed decision capital, which is, you know, it was very clear that it was paramount as an aspect of agency throughout both the educational leader and the educator flourishing interviews that we conducted. And what this looked like was really unique, because while the examples were really different, the theme was consistent, that the educators had made a choice and then they saw that choice in action. So one educator talked about how she was attending university as an educator, and because she was attending university, she was allowed to be out every Friday and had a substitute temporary replacement. Yeah. Then she had to do a practicum in another school for 10 weeks, and she was allowed to go and do the practice for 10 weeks in a different school and know that her job was still safe. Yeah. Sometimes she needed a study day at home because she had an assignment due and she was given that study day without having her pay docked. And these were examples of, and she concluded by saying, you know, I felt like they really just wanted me to do well. And that was based on the actions that were taken and by, you know, getting that autonomy. And another one of the leaders talked about, by giving teachers autonomy, you transition from compliance to innovation. And there are so many parts of the system that are reliant on compliance.
Yes.
And it takes away that supported, developed decision capital, because then there isn't room or space for that. And the second part to this is for our educational leaders, where we're giving them permission to not have to be, you know, as you would say, all things to all people.
Yeah,
because they, you know, when we go back to the model and look at the sun, you know, the leaders earning trust, one component of earning trust is intellectual humility, the ability to say, I don't know, and let's find out together. Yes. Or I don't know, we're going to turn to the experts on this. And it's really beautifully modeled by you through your own podcast that you had previously, you know, with so many people on, and how you shared examples of how you were as a principal by, you know, turning to people. And by doing that, you share the spotlight. You let other people step into that spotlight and shine where they can and give room for that. And so in a similar way, the coaching doesn't necessarily come from only the head of the school or only the principal or only one person, but the top of the school, whoever makes that decision, they give the permission for coaching cultures to exist. Yep. And then they choose, by doing that, they're choosing to share their power with the educators rather than using power over educators. And so then we have coaching cultures that are empowering everyone who's participating, just as our flourishing educators, when we have flourishing educators who exist, just by existing, they give permission to other educators to become flourishing educators because they see that it can be true.
Fantastic. And I think that, when you're explaining all of that, Brittany, and it's very, very clear when you explain it that way. When I think about educator flourishing, that idea of, personal professional development being a choice and having options as an individual teacher. I know over the last number of episodes, for our listeners who have listened in, we've had some tremendous examples of educators sharing that idea of autonomy and giving, staff choice in what direction they go within coaching, for example. And it has got to the point where, staff are trying to seek out jobs in these schools because they know it's a bespoke model of professional development. I love your phrase, moving from compliance to innovation. And the whole idea of compliance, we're just not going to get anywhere with compliance. But if we can give people that little bit of autonomy and go back to your phrase, supported, developed decision capital, then we can move towards a period of innovation because people are going to be allowed essentially to think for themselves, which is terrific. And yes, you talk about me giving examples of my own scenarios in the past, and a phrase I love to use, unfortunately I can't claim ownership of it, is that idea of losing the cape. As a principal, you can't be, everything to everyone. And I suppose that idea of being vulnerable and saying, look, I don't know the answer. Somebody else within the building does. Let's find out who does and support them on that. Finally, Brittany, can you share with us a little about the book that you're compiling at the moment and maybe how listeners can actually contribute to this fantastic process?
I had the idea to make the research into a book because the goal with dissemination is to reach as many people as possible. And the reality is not everyone is looking online at journal articles. So I wanted to make this information accessible. And I wanted to open up the opportunity for the experience of educators, whether or not they challenge or validate the theory. So I created a website where educators can submit their stories. And I chose to do this before I learned about the term story stewardship, but now I've heard this term and it so accurately embodies what I was trying to do, because I initially didn't quite have the language to articulate the importance and meaning behind providing a platform and space for educators to be heard in this way.
Yeah.
And so Dr. Brené Brown talks about story stewardship and how this means honoring the sacred nature of story in terms of what we hear and what we share. And that when we trust our stories to people who have earned the right to hear them and are able to tell them when we're ready, then it's a way that we can fully believe other people's experiences by what they tell us. Because so often we make assumptions about, we'll hear a circumstance and we'll decide in that circumstance how somebody felt. Or what the impact was, right? Back to intention and impact. And yet, really, what we need to be is better, especially as coaches, right? Like asking the question, like, how did that feel for you? Or what was that like in that experience? And so, by calling in our educators to submit their stories, I'm hopeful that they will have a chance to share their very real experiences of what they went through. And then, by doing that, and having it published and having it exist in the world, so many other educators will see themselves in those stories and remember that they're not alone. Because once we can remind our educators that you're not alone and that it shouldn't be this hard and that here are some ways that it can be better, or this is what the research says and, oh, interesting, this is what the story says, or this is what the research says and, okay, this story is actually something a little bit different or adds on or modifies this a bit. Then we have a space for that. So listeners can go to educatorflourishing.com and there's a place there to submit a story. In terms of having choice, there's an option to submit a voice recording or to type it out or to attach a file, different ways to send depending on preferences. And then we'll be able to create this together and have this co-creation and also extend the invitation of story stewardship and the importance of what that means.
Fantastic. Brittany, this really has been such a pleasure to have you on the podcast today. Your insights into the whole concept of educator flourishing and how it aligns so well with coaching and education has certainly been a great inspiration to me, and I'm sure our listeners also. I'd like to take this opportunity to wish you continued success as you share and implement your ecological model for flourishing educators. For our listeners, if you would like to find out more about Brittany's work, you can visit her website, as she said, at educatorflourishing.com. And if you have a story that you would like to contribute to her book, you can submit it via the website. In the meantime, I trust you will all join me on the next episode of Coaching in Education, where theory and good intentions meet reality.